Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. He just returned from a Pacific tour. Maybe he'll tell us a little bit about it, Tony. Welcome to our program.
That's right. Hi, George. Went all the way around the world. Southeast Asia route to New Zealand. Had a good stop in Hong Kong for a week, and then where I spoke to you, and then in New Zealand too, and then off to the Cook Islands, which was fascinating. Really interesting to see how societies can function when land property speculation is not the dominant feature, where people can actually get somewhere, space for themselves, a couple of acres, and build a house. And, you know, actually you've got there a very relaxed lifestyle with people kind of choosing, do I want a job or not? Actually, today I don't want, so I'm just going to potter around and maybe fix the roof and that sort of thing. So Cook Islands, although you look on all sorts of official statistics and find it's extremely poor, the fact is that people have got a lot of spare time there, and actually their quality of life is wonderful. They're very, very wealthy in terms of quality of life. So I wonder sometimes whether these kind of development indexes, where they say such a country is doing really well, actually means that the people are virtually slaves to money. Because that's the thing, is that the cost of housing, people growing their own food in places like the Cook Islands, are very, very low. So they don't really have to pay hardly anything for where they live, or not a lot for food, because they're growing a lot of their own. And their basic facilities are around. I just think it's fascinating to see this from a, you know, US-British point of view, where so many of us in Britain and America have to pay a lot for our housing and a tremendous amount for our food. The idea of growing some ourselves is just not on the table, because we don't have enough space to do it. Over there, they always make sure they've got plenty of space, and they make space if they haven't got it.
Boy, that was interesting, though, wasn't it? Huh?
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating part of the world. It's kind of like Hawaii, I guess, you know, for America, which Americans will be more familiar with, and not that far away, actually. Although that part of the world is really still quietly being contested, isn't it? Nowadays it's between the powers of US and China.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
I think you're in a situation where if things were to flare up tensions, which they could, of course, easily do with North Korea or in the Middle East, between the US and China, these Pacific islands would automatically, I think what we'd see Chinese ships popping up all over the place, Chinese soldiers running up beaches, and to deny the use of these islands to communicate and fly aircraft between around the whole of the South Pacific, so and Mid-Pacific. So, this is as quietly sitting behind the scenes as a tension there, although most of the islanders, I don't think, are really aware of the brewing tensions and the simmering hostility between US and China at the moment.
There's a serenity of life on those islands, isn't it, huh?
Yeah, there certainly is. Beautiful, really, really fantastic flora and fauna. I would say one of the most, you can basically get a nice flight there from LA to Rarotonga, and then you've got the choice of something like 10 or so outlying islands that you can then go and visit, which are really sparsely populated, really unspoiled. The locals are lovely people. And they'll look after you. If you fancy a little holiday in the cold weather at the moment in the US, that would seem to me to be a great place to go. It's a stop-off point that any New Zealand fly every day on the way to Auckland. So I guess they just stopped to refuel. But, you know, from the US, it's very accessible.
Did you like New Zealand? Do you really like it there?
Well, yes, you can't not like it, George. There's very few industries. I mean, okay, so there are some normal industries, but the main bulk of it all seems to be farming and forestry. Lots and lots of both going on, because it's such a vast land. There's loads of unspoiled, unused, unpioneered bush all over the place. And the other big industry is tourism, and finally repairing the roads. Because they had, for example, in the South Island, there was an earthquake at Kaikoura last year on the east of the South Island, which destroyed the roads and brought the seabed up about 2 metres out of the sea. So the coastline is very strange now. You've got houses facing out to sea, but there is no sea. There's just kind of rocks that are stuck up. Used to be the seabed.
Golly, that's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it's weird to look at, you know, especially if you're sitting on a kind of veranda looking out to sea, but actually there isn't a sea, there's just rocks and seagulls and a few seals sitting on top of the rocks, anyway. And the other industry, yeah, is this road building industry is a massive thing in New Zealand. All over the place you see minor repairs being made to roads because they have these constant slips due to rainstorms, and that just means that, you know, the road is impassable, and so the government pretty quickly get on the case to reopen the road. But some of the roads, like the one in Kaikoura, are right along the coast, so you've got, you know, sort of 30, 40 miles of coast road, which just in a night of storms can be half washed away. So they've got a lot of work to do to keep restoring this. And in that case, in the Kaikoura Road, they've got a railway there that also got washed away. So they've just finished restoring it, whatever it was, about a month ago. Then we looked on the TV after we'd just driven down it and saw that, oh dear, it's been swept into the sea again. So it's a constant job trying to keep these roads open, George.
Right. What's happening back in the UK? Is this nerve gas attack the primary news right now in the news, or what?
Well, it's just filling up the news, isn't it? And I was reading recently a very, very sharp analysis, I think, by the Russian ambassador to London. He was saying that the effect of this is really to fracture society in Britain. Because there's quite clearly enormous holes in this story. Well, you know, not least of which is that nerve agents are so incredibly deadly, it's almost impossible not to kill your target. And yet we've got three people who are alive and in hospital, and they haven't been killed. The police officer, apparently, who was contacted by this nerve agent, is now sitting up, he's fine. Now, you know, if you send somebody as an assassin to try and kill someone with a nerve agent, the chances are that, you know, not only will the person that you're targeting die, but the person who's administering this poison will die too.
Right.
So it is incredible that there's been, you know, this hasn't really been questioned. Three living people who, you know, nerve gas kills people, George, as you know, are just a tiny speck of the stuff, completely shuts down the human being's nervous system and stops the nerves working, so that means your body doesn't work anymore. You know, it's a pretty effective way of killing somebody. So it's amazing that there are all sorts of anomalies. Like, we're being told by the government here that we think that Putin might have done it, but we're also being told at the same time that he definitely did do it. Now, this is both the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and the Prime Minister Theresa May both saying both of these things. So they can't both be true. Either one or the other can be true. The other thing is that the real experts in chemical weapons in Britain are based at Porton Down, which is just a 10-minute drive out of Salisbury. Now, if I worked in Salisbury for the BBC in the early 1990s, and used to pass Porton Down every day on the way up to Swindon, when I was working up in Swindon, and on the A338, you know, so it was all very, very close proximity. Boscombe Down is also right next to Salisbury, which is the RAF's main, the great long runway there where they did test flying. They did the development of the bouncing bomb, which was used in the Second World War dam buster raids.
Oh, man.
Done at Boscombe Down. Right outside Salisbury is a place called Salisbury Plain, which takes up half of Wiltshire, which is this massive army, the biggest army and forces exercise training area in the country. You've also got certainly at least one underground nuclear weapons store just outside Salisbury in one of the villages, kind of tucked away, which people aren't supposed to know about. And then there's also the headquarters of UK Land Forces at just outside Salisbury. You know, there are umpteen military installations all around the city. The city is a military city, even though many tourists go there and visit the cathedral, which is a spectacular place, beautiful, you know, evensong services and things like that there. But you wouldn't necessarily know that there were these military everywhere. But they're all over the place. This is one thing that people that hasn't really been said much. I haven't heard any of the British press once say that the main British chemical weapons store is literally just up the road from Salisbury. Never, I've not heard that at all said. Not once. Well, it seems to be the most obvious thing to say. Anyway, they have just, with leaks have come out from the Foreign Office, saying that the nuclear and chemical weapons people at Porton Down have said that they cannot positively identify this as coming from Russia, this chemical.
Okay.
So this is a bit problematic for the government. So the military, you know, in a way, I think what they're doing is they're saying that we're not going there with this little game you're playing. And so what happens is, on Thursday, the Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson, who, before he was an MP, he was a fireplace salesman. I mean, he's a bit of a lightweight, really, and he was the one that said this quote, Putin should shut up and go away. That was the extent of his diplomatic language. But he has now announced £48 million for Porton Down. And the obvious thing to conclude or to speculate from that is this a bribe? Because Porton Down have not come along and said, agreed with what Theresa May wanted them to, and Gavin Williamson wants them to say, oh yeah, this is definitely from Russia, they're now being given £48 million. For what exactly? Maybe that's just the idea is to sort of sweeten them up so that when they come up with their next report to do with this whole scandal, that they falsely attribute this to Russia. I mean, I just don't believe any of this story, George. I don't even necessarily know whether these three people were seriously ill at all, whether they were faking it. I mean, it just seems to me like some kind of theatrical story designed, of course, to affect the standing of Putin in the presidential elections. I don't think it's going to actually have any effect. It'll just probably make intelligent Russians think, well, Putin is just being attacked here by the British. It's definitely designed to demonise Putin within Britain, but it also has the secondary effect around the world of making Britain look like it's very badly governed and a basket case.
Right. You know, I think this is a contrived deal to create a new Cold War to add to that and to demonize Putin in Russia. That's what it looks like to me.
Well, that's right. And I think there's lots of evidence that this, you know, there's so many flaws in this story, George. We keep hearing very different tales about what's supposed to have happened. The first policeman to arrive on the scene apparently was not a police constable, but a detective sergeant Now that means in the British police language that the guy was from CID, that's he's a detective.
Right, exactly.
Actually what happens in the normal course of events is that the police come across an incident. I mean, I'd imagine they would be called there by the ambulance people.
Right.
You know, that would be the normal course of events. But the ambulance people, it's not normal for a detective sergeant to be called to the scene. Also, we're now being told that, in fact, he wasn't called to the scene. He was called to their house. So their story keeps changing. So now he's not called to the scene out on the bench in the park in Salisbury. He's actually been called to the house of Sergei Skripal. Another basic thing is that there is actually no motive whatsoever for this. From the Russian point of view, this guy he was a double agent, and he served his sentence in prison in Russia, but then he was released, he was a free man in Russia. He just decided that he wanted actually to live out the rest of his life in Britain, therefore he was part of a spy swap after that. So there was no malice from Putin to get rid of the guy, whilst he could easily have done that, either in jail in Russia or over in... whilst he was a free person in Russia. There's just no motive. Also, you know, to do this just in the run up to the election is just not credible. You know, to try, you know, the idea, the story just doesn't fit with the circumstances. And also, you know, just forensically looking at, you know, what's supposed to have happened, where particular people were at the time. There was also an argument apparently going on in the restaurant before Sergei Skripal was found ill, and that hasn't been explained. Why was there some big argument going on, and what was that about? So there might be a kind of parallel story going on here, George, that we just simply haven't been told about.
Right. You know, his daughter flew in to Russia that afternoon, so she'd been living in Russia, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. So
they didn't hurt her over there. She has ability to live there, so... That sort of shows that the government's not moving against them.
Yeah, I've also seen certain... I mean, it's quite obvious also that the BBC and other broadcasters are being incredibly biased in their reporting of this. They're not showing both sides. They're not taking a point of view which is, well, you know, we should... go along with these international conventions on chemical weapons and do what they say. I think it's really transparent to me. There are two things going on in the world at the moment which point to the escalation. I mean, certainly the escalation of tensions between Britain and Russia does not benefit Britain. Okay, right. So why would we be doing it? The escalation of tensions. Britain is going through this whole Brexit program. Russia is one of the countries which it really needs to open up more trade links with. That would be quite feasible. You know, trade links between Britain and Russia by sea is very possible. You know, by land, by road, and rail, very possible. So we need to be negotiating a deal, and we need to start moving goods between Britain and Russia. And yet this acts against that. So whose interest is it in? It's in the interest of NATO. NATO and the US and the EU have been vehemently in support of this idiotic decision to expel 23 Russian diplomats. I mean, first of all, you don't do that sort of thing if you're not quite sure what happened. Well, we're being told by Theresa May that she is sure and that she isn't sure at the same time. Okay, so you don't make some sort of escalation and tension as a result of that.
Exactly. And
so what is going... I mean, the interest of NATO is being served by this. The interest of the Pentagon is being served by this. And ultimately, the interest of Israel, too, being served by this. Because we've got tension in Syria. Massive tension. Not really being reported... But the killing of Russian forces in Syria has led to this ultimatum a few days ago from the Russians saying, if you kill any more of our people, we will attack you and your people will die. So the Russians have been very clear about that statement, and that is the relation, you know, because basically they're losing the West's proxy forces, and also the trainers that the British and the Americans have got in there, the soldiers doing training, they're losing. And they don't like it. Of course they don't like it. And this was actually the Russian plan all along, to draw them into a fight that they were going to lose. And, of course, the British and the Americans don't like the fact that they're losing. And so they're looking at ways to retaliate. I think that's what's going on. They're very scared of the idea that all of this effort, taking over Libya and Iraq, these invasions, etc. Really, the key place that they wanted to take was Syria, and they're not able to do it. And they're getting annoyed about that. The other thing going on is the, you know, so we're just one step away from a US-Russian direct armed forces conflict in Syria. Just one step. I mean, in fact, it's already started. It's just the Russians haven't yet retaliated. They said next time they will. So this is very, very close.
Very dangerous.
Potentially nuclear conflict.
Right.
Getting ready in Syria right now. The other place where it's all happening is satellites orbiting planet Earth. I was chatting to, I don't know if you've come across him, and you've talked to him much, George, but an American guy called Bruce Gagnon down in Maine, and Bruce runs something called the Network Against Weapons in Space and Nuclear Power in Space. And he's a very close observer of all of the moves made in towards space weaponry and weaponizing space.
Right.
And he's pointed out, I had a chat with him after they made this announcement about Trump's Space Force. He wants to have this kind of Starship Trooper army, battalions, divisions, or whatever, up in space. Not necessarily people in space themselves, but running all sorts of satellite and destructive war equipment from space. So this really, what this means is the ability to destroy satellites. That's what we're talking about here.
Right,
and also,
right.
They have other satellites which can then have an effect on things going down on the Earth, whether that be some kind of ray which can kill somebody, you know, kind of Star Wars
not only had a defensive capability, but an offensive capability too.
Most definitely. And also, we're also now talking about the potential of nukes being delivered via satellite. Okay, so there's all sorts of technology out there that the military are keeping very, very quiet. But anyway, space is a very important potential battleground. I mean, what we've seen since World War II is the extension. I mean, that's really what I think the moonshot, the space program, was all about, was developing this technology, pumping vast amounts of money into dominating space. And we've also got, of course, since World War II, we've got this new kind of, what they call, cyber warfare.
Right.
And so a massive increase in propaganda and psychological warfare. We've also seen a massive increase in economic warfare, in other words, the use of sanctions as a form of warfare against a country. So of all these different forms, the one where the Americans are currently ahead, according to Bruce, I think his website is called spaceforpeace.org, with the number 4 or the letters F-O-R, spaceforpeace.org. And what he's saying is that you've got a situation right now where the Americans are ahead in that technology and they're ahead in space. They've got aggressive weapons in space, which they're not necessarily supposed to have up there, but they've got them anyway. And that the Chinese and the Russians have realised that this is a key battleground, and they're very catching up fast. So apparently the Pentagon actually wants to start a war in space, and in order to take out what the Russians and the Chinese have got already, so they can then dominate that sphere. So that's another theory as to why we're seeing these ridiculous moves, like this farcical story from Salisbury, in an attempt to ramp up tensions and potentially come to blows with Russia. I mean, I heard from Bruce last year, George, for the first time for anyone, that there was definitely regime change in Moscow was being planned. But I suppose that was inevitable when we got the Russians intervening in Syria. All of a sudden, there was a possibility that the West would think, well, no, we really don't want to take the Russians on because we might get nuked. and we might have a, you know, a really serious war, and millions of our people, hundreds of thousands of our soldiers would die. Actually, what it seems is that the Dr. Strangeloves in the US military have just said, well, the hell with that, we'll have a war anyway.
Right. The feeling that I get of what's going on right now is they're trying to maintain a separation between Putin and Trump. And it's the deep state on both sides that are giving both sides trouble, that are continuing to advocate a new Cold War between Russia and U.S. That's bad.
I think you're wrong. And also, I mean, we've got a very, very weak... I mean, all you need to do is just look up online the speech by Gavin Williamson here in Bristol last Thursday, which was one of the most puny, ridiculous speeches I've ever heard. And that just shows you how weak these people are, George. They don't know what they're doing. They really don't. So that's Thursday the 15th of March, 2018, Gavin Williamson's speech in Bristol at Rolls-Royce, who manufacture aero engines. Now, that was just... it was absolutely unbelievable to see such a weak speech, unconvincing. Effectively, what's happened, of course, is that, as David Rockefeller, God rest his soul, wanted, we've had governments weakened and weakened, and the big corporations become stronger and stronger. The strongest corporations amongst them all, really, being the banks. I mean, the banks can lend money to you, George. If you decide that you want to do a hostile takeover bid for the banks, in other words, take over a company to break it up, because that will mean that the competition can charge higher prices, you could get your whatever it takes, 30, 40 billion pounds, George, in your bank account to do that takeover bid. That's the power the banks have, is that they can just make this money up, effectively making it up out of nowhere, lend it out to somebody that's a hawk, that's prepared to sell their soul, to destroy an industry, to help turn it into a monopoly industry, to aid the cartel, because what we're living in is a cartel-run society now. And these companies then run the show. The governments have very little say. They do very little regulation. They're extremely weak. They're populated by weak people, weak-minded people who are not really interested in working as a public spirited way. And one thing I did discover in Singapore, which you might be interested in, is that actually being a member of a secret society in Singapore, George, is a criminal offence.
Really? Man. So, you know, the synarchy idea was that whole thing where the secret societies are running the politics from behind the scenes. You know, that's what's going on, right?
Of course, and it's interesting, isn't it, that actually Singapore is a very well-run place.
Yeah, it is. The laws are very strict, from what I understand.
Well, they are, but in a way, you know, the idea of sort of spitting in the street and dropping litter and chewing gum and stuff on the streets, they're very, very strict on these things. But all in all, the place is an amazingly easy place to make a living. Renting office space is relatively cheap. If you're making something which you can sell around the world, you're going to just be able to succeed in doing that. But the difference here in the UK is any kind of workspace or living space is incredibly expensive.
Right, right.
So it's very difficult to even just, whether you're doing a business or whether you're just at home with your family, you've got to get a massive amount of money in order to just tick over. So it's basically a landlord-run country, Britain. So the people who build things then work together to overcharge everybody that needs to use buildings to use them. And in a way, it's going back to the Cook Islands again, where it's totally the opposite. Land is very, very cheap, sometimes virtually free, and there's loads of it, there's quite a bit of space. But there is space here in Britain, it's just that it's all, people have been kicked out of the countryside, and they're forced into this. I mean, I was driving through Wiltshire today, and you can drive for miles and miles and not see a single house. It's just loads of fields, more and more fields. And so that's what we need here in Britain, is some kind of system by which people can start to just get on with their lives without having to try and scrabble around to pay the rent. So the landlords dominate. I mean, you know, we all need landlords, you know, you need to have people look after houses to rent them out, but the thing is now the market is such that everybody that wants to make easy money is just getting into charging ridiculous rents to people, and it's totally unsustainable. You know, you're talking about the average house price in London now at over £1 million for a small house. Nobody can afford this, and that's one of the reasons why we've got it's going through the floor, George. Home ownership in Britain is less than it's ever been, and it's plummeting because people cannot afford to buy. You've got big companies, big corporations that can afford to buy portfolios of homes, buy them just to let them out. And the end result of that is you get a society which is, you know, it's like chalk and cheese. It's completely different. You've got a landlord class that's doing well, and you've got a poor class that's finding it very difficult to make money and very difficult to pay the rent.
Yeah, it's a problem, that's for sure. But we just got to try to exist the best way we can wherever we are born and grow up.
We need to find some way. I mean, I think that landlords should obviously be financially rewarded for what they do. But yeah, when they start to this just it's what they call rack renting. You know, where they rack the rent up, you know, to as much as they possibly can, and even if no one is in their building, they still sit on that building as they don't care. They sit on that building just as an asset. So I just think there needs to be some kind of sensible halfway house where you know there's some sort of way of penalising landlords that overcharge, because you know otherwise people can't get on with their lives. They can't get on and make things, do things, manufacture things. They can't work. If there's no incentive to do so, you know, if all the money that they're working for is going to a landlord.
Right. What else is important going on right there in the UK right now? Anything else that you can think of that you need to talk about?
Well, I mean, the Salisbury issue is dominating, but yes, there's loads of other stuff going on. A lot of it is to do with the business of housing, though. I mean, I have been talking about that quite a bit.
Right.
But, we've got, for example, here in Bristol, they're bringing a congestion charge in, which is, it's pathetic, really. Everyone that drives their car in and out of the city is going to have to start paying money to do so, apparently.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean, you know, it's because they've been deliberately making it more and more congested, so they've got an excuse to do this. Another thing is the MI5, one of the brilliant stories in The Guardian last week, George, MI5 agents can commit crime in the UK. Well, I mean, we know they do, and I guess we know the FBI in the States commit crime, but it's now official. There is a tribunal, apparently, which is supposed to oversee this, and it says that the IPCO, it's called, it oversees the participants of MI5 agents in criminal activity, which was previously conducted by the now defunct Office of the Intelligence Services Commissioner, under a secret order referred to as the Third Direction. Well, I mean, you know, what the hell does that mean, the Third Direction? But anyway, this apparently is a secret document that no one's allowed to see, let alone no journalists, no public, which explains to MI5 officers in what ways they can commit crimes. Now, this is, you know, this is about Crown immunity, this really. Because they're officers of the Crown, they're commissioned by the Queen, just as the police are, and just as army officers would be, you know, anyone that gets a Queen's Commission, that means that they can commit crimes because they're part of the Crown, and the Crown is what does the prosecuting in this country. So obviously they can't be prosecuting themselves. So effectively you're looking at a sort of a system whereby anyone that's working for the Crown can do whatever they want and they cannot be prosecuted, and this includes the security services. So I would suggest that whatever's happened in Salisbury may include crimes by the security services, by MI5.
My gosh. That sounds really ominous. I mean, the whole thing is ominous everywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and also
peace talks are being built in all these nations. That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think also there's a fascinating guy in Britain called Max Mosley. Worth mentioning him because he is the son of Sir Oswald Mosley. Or Oswald Mosley, who was the fascist leader in the Second World War, running anti-Jewish marches and things like that in London, and starting riots, that kind of thing. And it was rather nice to see him confronted, because he was the boss of Formula One, which is the motor racing people, and he's also a very prominent figure in apparently trying to regulate the newspapers, but only because he was a very powerful person, the newspapers were criticising. And so he's been confronted with this leaflet that was reproduced in the 1950s to try and run for election. I mean, it just amazes me that someone like him, who was such a coming from this amazing fascist family, can be so wealthy. And I think we've got a real undercurrent of fascism actually here in Britain, and it's probably true to say in the States as well. One person I've been looking at quite a lot recently is this guy Anton Chaikin. I don't know if you've come across him, but he's done various talks in the US. He worked for the LaRouche. Have you come across them?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, LaRouche, I think you need to have a look at, because they're EIR, Executive Intelligence Review, they used to put out. I'm not sure, they probably still do. But he was working for them for a while, and he's an interesting figure. I mean, I've often had people saying to me, oh, they're terrible, LaRouche, you know. Actually, this guy's really, really interesting. And he's the son of a guy called Jacob Chaikin, who was the legal counsel for the American Jewish Nazi Boycott Committee.
Okay.
So he was in charge of the sort of legal shenanigans around, the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany, and his son has done some fascinating talks about usually it's to do with British Freemasonry and the British interference in the United States. So definitely check some of those out, George. And I play some of that on my show I do every week here. And obviously I've just started doing that again.
Tell our listening audience about your program there in Bristol.
That's right. Well, what we've done is we've done a 45-minute special on this Salisbury spy story, so you can have a listen to that, and you'll find it. If it depends how you like to listen, you can either download an MP3, you can sit down on your phone, listen to it at your leisure in your car or whatever, or else you can watch the YouTube. But you'll find links to both of them via the website thisweek.org.uk, and I think if you want a really comprehensive, it's very difficult to go into everything. My colleague Martin Summers and I really pulled the whole thing apart last night, and so you can have a listen to that 45-minute program. I could even, if I'm organised here, I could even tell you what it's called. It's called Novichok Hysteria. That's spelled N-O-V-I-C-H-O-K. That's this so-called nerve agent. Novichok Hysteria. MI6 fake news agent, Sergei Skripal, Salisbury nerve agent provocation. So, that's the title of it, so you can find it online, you can find it on YouTube, or you can go to thisweek.org.uk. And I think it's a pretty good attempt to get, up to speed on everything that's an implication of this provocation. I mean, we're living in a totally non-democracy, because Theresa May and the Tories have not been elected. The general election last year did not give them a majority. They've had to form this kind of dodgy coalition by bribing Irish loyalist unionist party, and also she hasn't been elected by her own party, so it's a spiffed government really effectively being run by the securocrats, by MI5, and with no real interest in ordinary people there.
Well, that sounds great, Tony. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. And you're always very insightful, and you've always got good backup on it, too,
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, and also, just keep an eye on this whole Space Force. I mean, it makes me laugh when Trump says, I just came up with this idea. Listen, even during the Obama era, the Pentagon was saying we want to have a space force, right? So it's not, this is not Trump's idea. He's just pretending it was, and he hopes no one realises it isn't.
Yeah.
Because Obama knocked it back, and the Air Force knocked it back. The fact of the matter is, though, I think this is part of the ramping up the arms race, which it seems to me is just a symptom of America and Britain trying to take on the Russians, because the real problem they've got with the Russians is nothing to do with Europe. It's all to do with Syria. And the inability that the Americans and the British have had to take control of Syria, which they were hoping and praying that they could, and now they're not. And that's why they hate Russia so much. And Putin, in a way, has wound up our ruling classes to such an extent that they're prepared to go to war with him over something which wasn't theirs in the first place. I think what he's doing is he's wound them up good and proper. And so we need to be very, I think, take seriously the threat, even potentially this summer, of a conflict. Maybe even next week. We've seen this, this threat, the Russians to attack the Americans in Syria if there's an attack on the Russians, and yet that hasn't really been transmitted properly to the people in Britain and America, that we've had this ultimatum from them, and so I think we're living in an extremely dangerous year. This summer could get really nasty really quickly, George, so just keep an eye open for what's going on, and I suppose try and inform your friends and family of just how appalling some of our leaders are.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Tony, for being with us this evening. And
no problem. I'll just plug a couple of my websites. One is the 9/11 Forum,
okay,
which is 911forum.org.uk. You'll find discussions and background running right the way back the last 10 years and even further, on all sorts of plots, assassinations, conspiracy theories, conspiracy facts. Discussions on almost every kind of scandal over the last 10-15 years, and that's 911forum.org.uk, and of course my good old Bilderberg website, which is happening and which has got a load of historical background on Bilderberg, and it's linked to the Nazis. So those three websites, that's thisweek.org.uk, 911forum.org.uk, and finally Bilderberg.org, George.
Okay, well, thank you, Tony. Appreciate it. Okay?
Thanks, George.
Okay, good evening.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Tony, thank you for being with us from Bristol. We're really happy that you had such a wonderful trip out in the Pacific, out in the Orient, if you want to say that. Coming up next is about 8-minute clip. Peter Thiel was interviewed, and he's talking about leaving Silicon Valley and moving to Los Angeles because Silicon Valley, those people out there, have become too totalitarian. So listen to this, and I'll add some comments at the end.
Start with Peter Thiel. The PayPal co-founder was one of President Trump's most ardent supporters during the 2016 campaign, a political position that was not popular in Silicon Valley. Maria sat down with Thiel for an exclusive, wide-ranging interview, starting with his continued support of the president.
You've spent almost your entire life in Silicon Valley, and you've decided recently to leave Silicon Valley, take your investment firm as well, and open up shop in Los Angeles. Why is this? What caused this?
Well, it's a decision that I've been thinking about for quite some time. On the technology side, I think that Silicon Valley will continue producing great companies, but perhaps not quite as many. For the last 20 years, you had this very strange dynamic where Silicon Valley was the only place where innovation in the United States really happened. And even though the Internet was supposed to eliminate the tyranny of place, you somehow had all the Internet companies happening in one particular place. And I think my judgment is that this will be much more distributed in the future, much more outside of Silicon Valley. There are certain pluses and minuses to Silicon Valley. The big advantage is that you have all the talent, all the capital in one place, and so you have these extraordinary network effects. And that's been a motor of Silicon Valley for a long time. But there's a point where network effects go very wrong, and where sort of the network effects, the fact that everyone's super connected, everyone knows what everyone's thinking, everyone ends up thinking the same thing, and it sort of shifts over into the madness of crowds. And I think that's that somehow we've gotten to the point where perhaps the negatives are greater than the positives.
Well, look, I mean, there are a lot of ideologies, and it's sort of one ideology. You backed President Trump in a big way, and Silicon Valley is very liberal. Do you get heat for that? Did you get heat for that?
You know, of course I got heat, and I don't want to exaggerate the importance of that. I think it's okay to be in a place where most people are liberal or most people have views different from my own. I do think there's something different when it goes from a large majority having one way to it being almost unanimous, where and because things are never unanimous. When people are unanimously on one side, that tells you not that they've all figured out the truth, but that they're in a sort of totalitarian place, that they're in a one-party state where they're not allowed to have dissenting views. And I think somehow Silicon Valley shifted from being, you know, quite liberal to being a one-party state. And those are two very different things.
What can we do about this? It's not just Silicon Valley, right? I mean, you look at universities. They push back on any conservative thinking. You could just pick up and move and take your business with you. But what is the country supposed to do when there's this pushback of a diversity of ideas?
Well, I've often said that our greatest political problem is the problem of political correctness, properly understood, because that's how we limit the debate, how we aren't allowed to consider all the possibilities, and certainly I think the universities share a lot of blame for this. The education system shares a lot of blame, but I think the pushback is you just have to try to push back in every specific context where you find it, and say the real debate is not this super narrow debate. There's a much broader range of possibilities we should be considering.
Why do you think LA is going to be any better?
I think it might be just as bad if I was trying to become a Hollywood movie star. Not planning to do that.
That's a good point.
I think it is a more diversified economy. So it's not dominated by just one industry. It's you have the entertainment industry, but you also have finance, you have tech, you have sort of a well diversified economic base, and I think it has much less of this sense of everyone being on top of one another, thinking the same way in one place. It's a very spread out city, which in many ways is a bad thing, but from a traffic point of view, things like that. But I think makes it much less ideologically homogenous.
Maybe it's more tolerance in terms of different ideas.
I think it is significantly more tolerant in San Francisco at this point.
Are you considering creating a new network, a conservative network, a libertarian network?
We've looked at doing something in the media content side for some time. The big challenge is really figuring out how to get the business model to work. The sense is that cable works, but it's not clear that's the future. The future's something that's more internet-centric, but it's still very unclear how one gets the business model to work from the content production side. And so I've spoken to a lot of different people, but I haven't yet figured out that problem.
There's a lot of information out there, and yet, the president termed fake news, and by the way, in a lot of situations, he was right. What's your take on what has taken place around Facebook in terms of the Russia involvement in the election and the advertisements around it?
I think, look, I'm on the Facebook board. I'm going to defend it, and I have to be careful what I say here. I think that Facebook, clearly would have liked to get ahead of this sooner, preferably even before the election, and done something to figure out about how to stop this sort of interference. On the other hand, this was a mistake that's very understandable. It was not generally thought that something like this would happen. And, if you remember what happened in the election, it was Trump in September, October of 2016 who said the election was going to get rigged, and it was Obama and Hillary Clinton who said that was ridiculous, that our elections were perfectly run in this country, and that it was outrageous for anyone to even suggest that. And I think the people at Facebook and elsewhere tended to believe what Obama said.
Sure, understandable. Let me move on to President Trump. What did you see in him that made you think that he was going to be a winner? What kind of policies would you like to see? How's he doing?
Well, the single thing that I saw in President Trump and that I still think is terrific is this willingness to challenge some of the orthodoxies, some of the politically correct orthodoxies in our country, to freshly rethink things in a variety of ways. And I think that's so critical for us moving forward. If you looked at so many of the Republican candidates in the primaries in 2016, they seemed like zombies. You know, they had sort of these rehearsed lines, but they weren't even that good at delivering these zombie-like lines. And I think Trump offered some very fresh energy in that context. And so I think I think in general, the question is how to move beyond the sort of glib globalization that we've been supporting for many decades, and ask some tougher questions about what kinds of policies are more in the interests of the United States, in the interests of U.S. citizens, in the interests of U.S. corporations. And I think that's a reset. Gradually but surely happening.
You're right, and you saw this early on, and it's important because there are a lot of communities in this country that have not been benefiting from some of the things that the globalists have been.
Well, it's even if you look at the big tax reform that was pushed through, it's basically designed to make taxes on American corporations more competitive globally. So you can say that's a way to compete globally, but it's also to be aware that things are not always an even playing field, and that we had gotten to the point where U.S. corporations were paying among the highest taxes in the world. And so if you're going to be globalist, you have to reset them and make them more competitive. So there's all these ways people were globalist but weren't really thinking it through.
There you go. That was Peter Thiel of Deutsch. It would be Peter Thiel. But anyway, he's German by way of San Francisco and the Silicon Valley, and he bought in and invested in PayPal way back and then sold that, and he's worth billions right now. One of the things I want to say about Peter Thiel is that he's still a member, as far as I know, of the Bilderberg Group, and that's one of the most powerful groups in the world. And at one time, or he may still be, he was on the steering committee. Now, that steering committee means that you're at the top level of the Bilderberg Group. So he's talking, in this interview about he thinks that the Silicon people are becoming too totalitarian. But in essence, he's sitting on the steering committee or a member of the Bilderberg Group, which is ultra, ultra high power group in the world. One of the strongest high up groups in the world that exercises power. And let me tell you about the Bilderberg Group. There's kings and queens there at times. There's central bankers there. There's a Bank of England head, this and that. The Bank of International Settlements has people there. These are big, big money people. And they meet and they plan out where the world is going for the next 12 months. And they can make it happen. You have people that have interest in large corporations. They are corporate people. They also show up, some of the same people, show up at the in Davos, Switzerland, which is usually another big meetup group of corporate entities. And the Davos group is a World Economic Forum around which the major corporations are showing up there every year. So you not only have the Bilderberg group, which is only about 120 or 30 people of the top power people in the world. Then later on, usually in January of the year, usually they meet between the Bilderberg meets in the end of May into the first week of June every year. Now, get back to Davos. Davos is an annual meeting in the end of January at Davos, Switzerland. It's called the World Economic Forum, and it meets, and they have very, very powerful people there, see. But it's around the theme of economics and so on. But they discuss a wide range of subjects, earth warming, so forth and so forth. So they get into all kind of a range of different subjects, you could see. But anyway, I thought that I'd play this Peter Thiel. The first 40 minutes there was with Tony Gosling. He's a broadcaster out of Bristol, England. We've been having him on here periodically for quite a few years because he gives us that UK slant of things, see. And what it is that if you look at the UK and then you begin to see what's going on there, then you have to, what follows what the UK lead is doing sometimes is going to happen here. I mean like police state tactics and also the British are masters of mind control. So it's a good idea to keep your ear to the ground on what Great Britain is doing. They funded a 5-year program over there to take down and to discredit any kind of conspiratorial scholarship and research and programs here that are individuals. They try to discredit the JFK, the RFK, and all these other things that individuals in this country, especially Americans, have been concerned with over the years. So that's what they do in Great Britain is they have a lot of money, they command a lot of power, and they'll go out and use that money to do mind wash and mind control types of major worldly geopolitical mind wash types of operations. So this little nerve gas attack over there, don't believe it. You just can't believe it on the surface. Thank you for listening. A little end note here. I'm sorry we had to do a little filler here. But anyway, this is thesecrettruth.com. We broadcast every Saturday night from the site thesecrettruth.com. We usually have 2 hours. The first hour tonight was a plethora of different clips. We covered a lot of different news and so forth. And then we got into other things later in the second hour with Tony Gosling. And then I played about an 8-minute clip of Peter Thiel and the reasons why he was interviewed and the reasons why he's leaving the Silicon Valley and relocating to the Los Angeles area. He is a member, like I said earlier in this hour, of the Bilderberg Group. So. And also he established Palantir, which is an internet intelligence gathering system. And so the top leadership in the world is profiting from the use of that particular program. That Palantir has several programs that go out and do mining of the web. And then they report back to the user, the operator. And it's a tremendous intelligence gathering operation. And so only the top people in the world have access to some of these programs because they're so expensive. So anyway, I just wanted to sort of bring you up to date on that and let you know what's going on there. But thank you again for listening. I just had to fill this last few minutes here and reiterate some of the information that came up with. Thank you for listening. Good night.